since the beginning of the pandemic just to get enough masks and gowns to keep them safe while they're trying to save lives. And in between, you know, they've been, the nurses unions like National Nurses United, like New York State Nurses Association, have been the loudest voices in this country saying, for again, for decades, that we need a real national healthcare system that would actually prioritize public health, because this pandemic has taught us that we are only as well as the last person to get vaccinated, as the last person to get healthcare.
We want to thank you, Sarah Jaffe, for being with us, longtime labor and economic justice reporter. Her new book, Work Won't Love You Back, How Devotion to Our Jobs Keeps Us Exploited, Exhausted, and Alone. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Neil Shabata. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Adriana Contreras. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley. Wearing a mask is an act of love. Wearing two is even better. And try a shield on top of it. I'm Amy Goodman.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
I would like to think that Chicago was not a promised land, but it was definitely a short-lived heaven for black people.
Join KBOO on Wednesday, February 24th at 6:30 p.m. for an online panel discussion featuring the filmmakers of the documentary BAM, Chicago's Black Arts Movement. Panelists also include Chicago poets Angela Jackson, Illinois Poet Laureate, and Yesenia Eugene Perkins, esteemed poet and youth advocate. Register online to attend this free KBOO event. Everyone who registers will get a link to the full documentary for up to a week before the panel for viewing. Again, that's BAM, Chicago's Black Arts Movement, online panel discussion on Wednesday, February 24th at 6:30 p.m. For more information and to register to attend the panel, go to our website today at kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland General Electric is still struggling to restore power to hundreds of thousands of Oregonians. Portland police came to the aid of a dumpster yesterday amidst claims that they are understaffed, and misogynist and racist radio personality Rush Limbaugh has died at age 70. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 17th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. The Oregon Health Authority reported 473 new cases of COVID-19 on Wednesday, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 151,257. Oregon health officials reported 5 new deaths, bringing the death toll to 2,143 people in the state. OHA said case and lab result counts are lower than expected due to the winter storm and hazardous travel conditions. Multnomah County had the highest number of new cases with 55, followed by Deschutes County with 50. So far, more than 700,000 first and second doses of the COVID vaccine have been administered across the state. Many public schools in the state are preparing to open in April, but more than 40% of public school buildings in the Portland area are over 90 years old, raising questions about their ability to be properly ventilated. An analysis done in 2020 found that the buildings collectively need $203 million worth of HVAC repair, and $34 million of that is considered a matter of, quote, health and life safety. Nationally, the United States has reported 27.8 million cases of COVID-19. More than 488,000 people have died across the country. Coronavirus cases have been declining across the U.S., but experts are warning that infections remain high nationwide and people should continue to follow precautions to slow the spread of the virus. The Biden administration announced on Wednesday that it is pledging nearly $200 million to better identify emerging threats. That money will go to better coronavirus sequencing in labs, which may help more quickly identify new strains of the virus. Concurrently, the FDA is preparing for a potential redesign of the COVID-19 vaccines to better protect against the new variants. President Biden said on Tuesday that he expects everyone who wants a vaccine will be able to receive one by the end of July. His statement comes amidst news that Johnson & Johnson is nearing completion of its version of the COVID-19 vaccine, which only requires one dose. To date, 36 million doses of a vaccine have been administered in the United States, making it likely that we will easily reach the Biden administration's aim of vaccinating 100 million people in President Biden's first 100 days. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 110 million people in nearly every country. There have been 2.4 million deaths across the world. Over 100,000 Portland households are still without power after a historic winter storm hit the Portland metro area last Thursday. Portland General Electric called the outages a challenging and dynamic situation for restoration crews in a press conference today. While the worst of the weather has passed, crews are working overtime to keep up with an ever-changing situation. Icy conditions last Sunday caused thousands of trees and branches to crack under the added weight, damaging hundreds of miles of power lines. In response, PGE has tripled its workforce, calling in help from as far as Montana. With more than 200 miles of transmission lines down, the company has prioritized restoring power to essential services such as hospitals, elder care homes, and water treatment facilities. They are now focused on restoring power to the majority of Portland residences and businesses. PGE estimates at peak outages, there were 350,000 customers without power on Monday morning. That number is now down to 148,000, and PGE expects to have reduced that number to 100,000 by Thursday. Even as crews repair outages, they are still contending with new outages. Dale Goodman is the director of utility operations. Goodman says that there are some of the most dangerous conditions he's ever seen due to fallen trees, debris, branches, and damaged power lines. The company says it is difficult to say exactly when all customers can expect to have their power restored, but they expect significant progress to be made in the coming days. PGE is urging residents to exercise caution around damaged power lines and trees. They also recommend that customers go to portlandgeneral.com/outages to monitor outages in their area and get the latest information on progress being made in their neighborhood. Police in Portland yesterday showed up in large numbers to guard a dumpster full of food. The Hollywood Fred Meyer threw out hundreds of pounds of perishable foods yesterday after losing power in the snowstorm, but refused to allow folks to retrieve any of the trashed items. Activists began showing up around 2:30 p.m. in an attempt to gather the food, which was, by the store's account, trash in a dumpster. Activists intended to share the food with houseless folks and others who may be experiencing food insecurity. At around 4 p.m. on Tuesday, Fred Meyer employees called the Portland Police Bureau, which, according to the Bureau's press release, was initially unable to respond but then sent 11 officers to the scene. Fred Meyer employees had apparently been instructed that the food was unfit for consumption and therefore could not be taken off-site. This is a common policy and practice among corporations that sell perishable items. Some stores even pour bleach or detergent on items in order to discourage dumpster diving. However, as 80 billion pounds of food is wasted every year, and with so many experiencing income loss and food insecurity, mutual aid groups often attempt to gather at least some of the items that have not spoiled and share them with the community. At least 12 free fridges around the city were filled with some of the food gathered by mutual aid activists. Rush Limbaugh, a conservative, misogynistic, and racist icon, died Wednesday at the age of 70. After years of promoting tobacco use and claiming it had no side effects, he died from a battle with lung cancer. For 32 years, Limbaugh hosted The Rush Limbaugh Show, a nationally syndicated program with millions of loyal listeners who tuned in for his version of conservative infotainment. He was known for passionately promoting conspiracy theories, as well as providing homophobic, racist, sexist, misogynistic, and anti-Semitic commentary. He fanned the flames of birtherism, which claimed President Obama was born outside the United States. He provided support and cover for his friend, President Trump, and most recently, he supported the far-right insurrection against the Capitol. On his show, he once told an African-American caller to, quote, take that bone out of your nose and call me back, and mocked the dialect usage of axe instead of ask when discussing black activists. He also delivered, quote, AIDS updates, mocking the often excruciating deaths of people with AIDS, set to a background song by Dionne Warwick. Limbaugh was memorialized by publications across the globe, including The New Republic, which wrote, quote, Limbaugh's politics were forged in a crucible of hatred and cruelty. His racism and extraordinary misogyny are the only standout contributions he made. The Cherokee Nation is helping the state of Oklahoma conserve energy as snow continues to fall across the state. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma is helping conserve energy as snow continues to fall across the state. Cherokee Nation businesses, including 9 casinos, are temporarily closed through Friday as the region faces utility shortages and winter weather warnings. Tribal business officials are assessing conditions and say the Cherokee Nation is doing its part for the safety and well-being of the community. Reopening is expected Friday afternoon, but could change as officials consider weather and energy conditions. The Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources has scheduled a hearing to consider the nomination of Deb Haaland for Secretary of the Interior. The hearing will be held Tuesday morning, February 23rd, in Washington, D.C. As a member of Congress from New Mexico, Haaland, Laguna, and Haymans Pueblo has been a strong advocate for Native American and environmental issues. Tribal leaders in recent weeks have continued to voice support for Haaland, hopeful a Native American will lead the Interior Department. After a number of Republican members of Congress are opposing her nomination over concerns of resource development. Committee members will participate in Tuesday's hearing both in person and virtually. It will be streamed online for the public. A Native woman running for mayor of Seattle reflects on growing up in a small town in Alaska. Tim Ellis with KUAC has more.
Colleen Echohawk began her journey 44 years ago in the small town of Delta Junction, Alaska, where she was raised. Echohawk says growing up in a small town helped her appreciate the ties that bind a community together.
There is a lot of diversity in the little towns.
Diversity like Echohawk's father, Howard, a Pawnee Indian who came to town in the 1970s to work for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Echohawk says her father taught her and her 7 sisters and brothers that they should be proud of their heritage and learn more about it.
Every day he would say to us, you are a Pawnee, you are an Echohawk, and you can do anything.
She gained an even greater appreciation of her identity when a similarly multicultural family moved in next door. The father of the family next door was Fred John, son of Katie John, the renowned Otna Athabascan, whose decades-long legal fight led to greater subsistence fishing rights for Alaska Natives. Echohawk says she was inspired by Katie John's determination to win the case.
We had the incredible privilege of seeing her fighting for subsistence. We had the incredible privilege and honor for us to call her Grandma Katie.
After she graduated from high school in 1994, Echo Hawk went to college, earned degrees, then traveled around the country and abroad before settling in Seattle in 2003. There she worked for the American Indian Heritage Middle College before taking a job with the Chief Seattle Club, an organization that helps urban Native people in need. She's now its executive director. Echo Hawk says the success of the Seattle Club's program and her appreciation of communities big and small led her last month to declare her candidacy for mayor of Seattle.
That was Tim Ellis reporting. Jasmine Blackwater Nygren, Navajo, was sworn into the Arizona State Legislature last week to replace a representative who resigned to join the Biden administration. Emma Gibson from Arizona Public Media has more.
Blackwater Nygren recently passed Arizona's bar exam, and she's worked within the Navajo Nation's legislative and judicial branches. She received her bachelor's degree from Stanford and her law degree from Arizona State. Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez congratulated the new member of Arizona's state legislature, and he said he always encourages young members of the nation to get an education, then help their communities. Myron Sosi is the other state representative for District 7, which covers a large portion of the Navajo Nation. For National Native News, I'm Emma Gibson.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Noise Filter, Debunking Coronavirus. Then at 5:45, it's News from the Boo, your look at the news inside KBOO with station co-manager Jenna Yokoyama. At 6, it's Rural Roots Rising. At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, stick around for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy skies with a low of 35 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 43. Today in history, in 1942, revolutionary activist and co-founder of the Black Panther Party, Huey P. Newton, was born. The Black Panther Party established over 60 community support and mutual aid programs, including food banks, medical clinics, and their own ambulance service. Despite graduating from high school not knowing how to read, Newton taught himself to read and earned a PhD from UC Santa Cruz in 1980. He was murdered in 1989 by a member of the Black Guerrilla family. The quote of the day is from Newton, who said, quote, "Revolutionary suicide does not mean that I and my comrades have a death wish. It means just the opposite. We have such a strong desire to live with hope and human dignity that existence without them is impossible. When reactionary forces crush us, we must move against these forces, even at the risk of death. We will have to be driven out with a stick." Open enrollment for health insurance through the Affordable Care Act is now available until May 15th. Here's Mark Richardson with a closer look at the situation.
It was originally nicknamed Obamacare, but a lot of people are now calling it Bidencare. That's because President Joe Biden has reopened the Affordable Care Act to help Arizonans and others who lost health insurance during the pandemic. Registration for coverage through the health insurance marketplace is now available through May 15th. Healthcare experts estimate that 85% of eligible applicants will qualify for financial assistance with their premiums, and many will also qualify for help with deductibles and copays. Alan Gerfig with Cover Arizona says the Biden administration is restoring a key part of the program to publicize the special enrollment period.
The new administration is going to put $50 million into marketing and advertising to help people understand that they have an opportunity, if they're uninsured, to get covered.
The Trump administration tried but failed to eliminate the ACA, although it did cut funding for key parts of the plan, including money for information and registration assistance. Biden promised during the 2020 campaign to expand and improve the program. Gerfig says at the start of 2020, about 1 in 10 Arizonans did not have health insurance, and job losses caused by the pandemic may have increased that number. He says people who need coverage should go online and shop around.
There are thousands of people in Arizona that could get a free bronze plan. Their financial assistance for the premium would be 100% covered, and they would also be receiving help to reduce those out-of-pocket expenses.
Griffith says his group, Cover Arizona, is geared up to assist Arizonans during the special enrollment period and, as they say, Operators are standing by.
We also hold the only health insurance navigator grant in the state. We work with 180 different sites through our community health centers that all have certified application counselors.
You can enroll directly with the health insurance marketplace at healthcare.gov. If you need assistance, contact Cover Arizona and talk with a volunteer, or if you prefer, set up a face-to-face meeting. Call 800-377-3536 or go to coveraz.org. For Public News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
Former President Trump is facing more legal woes while vying for GOP leadership with Mitch McConnell as investigations continue into the Capitol insurrection. With more on that story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
I am privileged to partner with the NAACP to have my day in court so that the perpetrators of putting members of Congress at risk can be held accountable.
Mississippi Congressman Benny Thompson says he feared for his safety during the Capitol siege. The NAACP and a civil rights law firm are suing former President Donald Trump and some of his allies on behalf of Thompson. Here's NAACP lawyer Jeanette Wallace.
Donald Trump, Rudolph Giuliani, the Proud Boys, and the Oath Keepers tried to disenfranchise African-American voters by not having the election results certified.
Civil rights attorney Joseph Sellers is part of the lawsuit. Their argument is that Trump violated the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871 by conspiring with white supremacist groups to incite the January 6 insurrection.
The statute, at the time it was enacted, was intended to protect members of Congress who were from the southern states attempting to participate in the reunited National Congress after the Civil War and who were threatened by groups like the Ku Klux Klan.
And while a Trump advisor disputes Thompson's claims, the former president could soon face criminal charges in another case. Georgia prosecutors are looking into Trump's efforts to overturn that state's 2020 election results. Trump finally responded to Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell's post-trial declaration that the former president was responsible for the insurrection. In a statement, Trump called McConnell a political hack and said Republicans will lose in 2022 if they continue to support McConnell. The first public hearing with officials responsible for security at the U.S. Capitol before the attack will be held a week from today. The former House and Senate sergeants at arms and the Capitol Police Chief are expected to be top witnesses at the Senate Homeland Security and Rules Committee hearing. And White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters that President Joe Biden supports House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's effort to establish a panel similar to the 9/11 Commission.
President Biden has made clear his views on the tragic events of January 6th, including where responsibility for them lies. He backs efforts to shed additional light on the facts.
In his first official trip, Biden attended a socially distanced CNN town hall last night in Milwaukee, stumping for his $1.9 trillion COVID relief package. House committees have been meeting remotely during this week's recess to hammer out the final details of the proposal. Speaking of COVID relief, $400 million from the CARES Act is being credited for helping make 2020's election the most secure in history. Benjamin Hovland chairs the Election Assistance Commission. He told a congressional committee that election officials went above and beyond.
You had about 95% of Americans vote on a paper ballot or a paper audit trail. Obviously, in a number of the close states, we saw exhaustive audits and recounts, hand inspection in Georgia that reconfirmed the machine tallies, and all that was very important. Having confidence in the elections.
For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
A school district in Arkansas has gone solar, saving over $300,000 a year and using that money to boost teacher pay. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In Batesville, Arkansas, teachers are getting raises, thanks in part to solar power. Megan Renahan is communications coordinator for the Batesville School District. She says that 4 years ago, teacher salaries were below average for the state and lower than other districts in the county.
In order to attract and retain our staff, we wanted to increase the pay.
So the district started looking for ways to cut costs. At the time, it was spending more than $500,000 a year on utilities. To reduce its energy costs, the district installed thousands of LED lights, replaced windows and HVAC units, sealed leaks, and improved building insulation. And it installed almost 1,500 solar panels that now generate about half of the district's electricity.
We were the first school district in the state of Arkansas to invest in solar panels.
Together, the solar power and energy efficiency improvements are saving the district more than $300,000 a year. Along with other cost-cutting measures and state funding, those savings have helped raise teacher pay across the district.
And that money is going to continue to go back into our teacher salaries. That's the whole goal. We want to be the best in the area for our teachers because that means that our kids are getting the best.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
A proposed bill in New Hampshire would give park rangers important anti-racism and de-escalation training, setting a precedent for the rest of the country to follow suit. Here's Lily Bolke with more on the story.
New Hampshire lawmakers are proposing a new bill, the Inclusive Outdoors Act, to require conservation officers to be trained for civil rights enforcement, anti-racism, and de-escalation. With many people restricted from gathering indoors, they're making use of the Granite State's parks and other outdoor spaces more than ever. State Representative Maria Perez of Milford says she's experienced racism in her community's outdoor areas, and she wants to make sure they are welcoming environments.
People coming and visit our parks and recreational areas is bringing a lot of revenue to our state. But I just want to make sure that we, you know, when we welcome these people, that everyone feel like they're part of the community. They don't feel segregated.
Last year, leaders with New Hampshire Audubon found white supremacist vandalism at their Concord sanctuary. The bill would establish a database for tracking these types of instances, and its backers hope it would also make people more comfortable reporting them. Supporters of the bill acknowledge that it won't end racism in outdoor public spaces, but will send a message that the state is being intentional about trying to combat it. Perez hopes the trainings will help more public officials understand the harm caused to New Hampshire's residents of color.
As an immigrant and as people of color, myself, we go through discrimination, and a lot of times police officers don't know how to handle the situation.
Close to 70% of visitors to national forests, wildlife refuges, and parks are white. During this health crisis, Perez says it's all the more important to make sure people feel safe as they're taking advantage of the beautiful outdoor spaces New Hampshire has to offer. For Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke.
A new disease is spreading amongst deer, and stricter management has been proposed to keep it from hitting other parts of the United States. For more, we go to Nadia Ramlagan.
A disease in the same family as mad cow disease is spreading among deer, and this week state officials will decide on new rules to help contain it. Chronic wasting disease was first identified in Arkansas in 2016, but state wildlife veterinarian Dr. Jennifer Ballard says because infection is hard to detect, it likely persisted long before then. Scientists believe it's caused by highly contagious proteins called prions that spread between animals through body fluids or indirectly through soil or water. Ballard says CWD poses a huge threat to deer populations.
We're concerned about it because there's evidence based on its long-term persistence in western states that this can actually cause population declines when it reaches a high prevalence.
CWD eats away at animals' bodies, causes behavioral changes, and ultimately leads to death. The proposal would remove fawn and yearling bucks, which have higher rates of CWD, increase the bag limit for harvesting deer in and near affected areas, and limit baiting and feeding on private lands. Some hunters oppose the changes. Ashley Chance of the National Wildlife Federation's Artemis Program points out that deer hunting contributes significantly to Arkansas's outdoor recreation and tourism economy. She says tackling CWD is critical to ensuring sustainable deer populations for the future, which means humans have to watch their behavior too.
As somebody in Arkansas who cares about deer in any way, whether you want to hunt them or you just want to continue seeing them on the landscape, really stopping concentrating them, whether it be with artificial feeding or bait sites, I mean, that's probably the single biggest thing you as an individual can do to impact the trajectory of this disease.
Ballard adds that chronic wasting disease goes beyond outbreaks in deer and says once prion proteins are found in the environment, they can remain in those areas for years.
When you bring animals together, if you have even one infected animal, they're going to have the opportunity to infect other animals, but they're also going to potentially be depositing prion into that environment that can infect other animals well into the future.
Current research shows no evidence of transmission to humans, but some experts say CWD could potentially pose a health risk down the road. According to the CDC, lab studies have found the disease has been transmitted to monkeys that were fed infected deer meat. For Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 17th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Anna Fox. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, Nadia Ramlagan, Mark Richardson, and Mary Sherman. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Want to send some birthday wishes to my sister. Happy birthday, Charlotte. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 9, it's Fight the Empire, connecting history with current events. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, tune in for Radio Zine, featuring a variety of exciting public affairs programming. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
My name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
All right, welcome to Noise Filter. This is Dr. Mark Allen Derry. Doc Griggs is not able to be with us today. So this is one of my favorite segments in which I get to review some of the interesting public health research that has come out in the past week. So let's go ahead and get started. Okay, as we continue on with one of my favorite segments, which is the public health segments, that gives me an opportunity to review some of the best data and articles looking at public health and COVID-19 that will have real life application to you. So let's get on with the stories. So the first story we're going to talk about today is looking at temperature scanners. You know those temperature scanners that you walk through in an airport, if you're going to airports right now? And essentially what these researchers did was they wanted to look and see how accurate the infrared body scanners are at detecting fevers. So they basically conducted a review of the literature to determine the accuracy of these large-scale body scanners. And what they found was that temperature alone is not a reliable indicator of COVID. Now, we know that. We've said that in previous episodes that 60% of people are asymptomatic. So it's only, technically, it's only really a minority of people who have a fever associated with COVID. But still, we know that temperature is not a reliable indicator. Skin temperature does not give an accurate estimation of core temperature. So what does that mean? So the temperature on the surface of your skin, for example, as you're walking through a scanner, what you're emitting off of your skin in terms of temperature does not necessarily reflect what's really your real core temperature, the temperature that's inside your body. So this is why when we take a temperature, we put a thermometer in your mouth, or we put a thermometer inside your ear, right? Those are some of the best indicators of core body temperature. Now, what they essentially found was, of course, the use of these temperature scanners just were of limited value. But what they did do, interestingly enough, was they found in their research that if you were to take the temperature emanating from the surface of your eye and the temperature emanating from the surface of your index finger, and you take the difference of those temperatures, you will actually get the most accurate indication of what your core temperature is. So right now, obviously, these machines are not set up for that, but that was kind of an interesting observation that they made. So essentially, body temperature scanners, like those that are used in airports, can lead to a large number of false negatives, and it really is not something that we should be using because there's so many environmental factors like air temperature or humidity or air velocity or individual factors like age or gender or morphology, anxiety, or even non-thermal factors like hydration status or hypoxia or alcohol use. So it's really, they're really not great for COVID scanning or for COVID testing, but right now it's the best that we can do. So we'll continue to follow up with this story. Okay, so this next study looked at how long does the immune system make antibodies for the SARS-CoV-2 virus, right? The virus that causes COVID-19. So what they did was the authors collected blood samples from 87 people 1 month and at 6 months from folks that were infected with COVID-19, and they monitored their levels of antibodies and memory B cells. What they also did too is they did some biopsies of their small intestine as well. And the results of this were fascinating. So what they found was that, we've talked about this before, that the immune system is divided into two. You have the innate immunity and the acquired immunity. Now listen, as somebody who does immunity and immune, as an infectious disease doctor, I deal with immunity all the time. I am the first to tell you the immune system is incredibly complex, and I only know a very, 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 it's just the surface of immunity. So, but let me share with you what I know. The innate immunity is something that you have within you, and that's where the memory B cells live, right? Those are where where if you were exposed to something, like let's say 7 years ago, you're exposed to it again, your cells wake up, they say, I remember that, and then they pump out antibodies, and that's the acquired system where the antibodies are made. So what they found was that the acquired part of your immune system where antibodies are made, they lasted about 6 months for COVID-19. They found that the memory B cells lasted also for a long time. And what we've seen with SARS and MERS in the past was that your memory B cells can last multiple years. And in fact, in some recent cases, they took folks that had SARS from 2003, and they found that they still had memory B cells toward the SARS-CoV-1 virus. So we're hopeful that we will have antibodies for long periods of time against the COVID-19 virus. But here's the thing that was really interesting. When they did the biopsies of the small colon, remember we said that they took biopsies of intestine? What they essentially found was viral particles, in fact, buried inside cells of the intestines. And what they speculated was that the virus remained inside cells, and that helped keep the antibodies active for about 6 months or so. So it was really fascinating. And it could also explain how antibodies continue to be produced long after a virus has been cleared from our system. So In short, here essentially antibodies are produced for up to 6 months, according to the study, and it's consistent with the viral antigens that are located in the intestine. It's amazing. And what we do see is that memory B cells are intact. So this is good. I think that even though we may be at a time where we may have to be vaccinated pretty regularly, if not annually, maybe biannually, so every other year or what have you, against coronavirus, I think that in terms of us being vaccinated for COVID-19, I think that our immune system will remember COVID-19 virus for a long time and will be protected against it. On this next story, this one I call How to Drive the Coronavirus Away, and you'll see why I call it this in a moment. But this is really one of those studies that really have real-life practical application to you, because what they looked at here was, what's the transmission risk of COVID-19 inside a car? So what they did was they basically took a Toyota Prius that was driving about 50 miles an hour with two occupants. You had a driver and you had a passenger sitting in the back seat opposite one another. So the driver sitting in the front left, the passenger sitting in the rear right-hand side. And what they found was that when windows were up, right, when the windows were up, so none of the windows were open, 10% of exhalation of one person would reach the other. Ugh, that's gross. 10% of what comes out of somebody else's mouth, you inhale when the windows are closed. When all the windows were open, however, that went down to 0.2 to 2% of exhalation would reach one another. But what they found was that the greatest circulation of air occurs when windows were open opposite individual. So for the driver, that would be the front right window. And for the passenger, it would be the rear left window, right? And what that did is that created the greatest amount of circulation and in fact created something that they refer to as an air curtain, protecting the driver and the passenger. So if you're in a cab, or if you find yourself in an Uber or Lyft, please sit opposite the driver. So this study only looked at two people and they were unmasked. So hopefully these are better if you're masked, but essentially have the window opposite you and opposite the driver open, and that will allow for the greatest circulation to occur. And so this is how we drive the coronavirus away. Let's Yelp. If you've been concerned about how businesses and restaurants are handling safety precautions, Yelp is now updating its COVID-19 section to address just that. These sections will now include information on businesses are enforcing masks and social distancing. Yelp wants to ensure that consumers are secure about supporting local businesses, but are also safe. Before the complaint is posted, a few things need to be checked off. The complaint needs to be backed up by multiple accounts. Complaints from a month prior up until the present can be and will be sued, and each complaint will be evaluated daily to ensure accurate portrayal of the business. If recommendations are being followed, there will be a green check, and if not, there will be an orange check mark. On top of this, Yelp will also provide more detail about the restaurant having contactless menus, meal kits, and heated and outdoor dining. Now, a little something extra as well. Here in Southern Louisiana, we refer to that as lanyap. So a little something extra as well. Yelp has included warnings about overly racist businesses. That's lanyap indeed. So if you go out to grab food or anything, make sure the businesses you're attending is following safety precautions, but not only for your protection, but for the protection of your community as well. And let me just say, bon appétit. COVID-19 hits Mexican health workers hard. Mexico's health ministry shows that since the virus began spreading in the country, nearly 2,500 healthcare workers have died from coronavirus, and 188,000 were infected since the beginning of 2021. That compares to an estimated 3,132 healthcare workers in the U.S. at the same time. However, the U.S. has nearly three times Mexico's population. Wall Street Journal reports that Mexico's healthcare workers are so poorly paid that they take on extra shifts or other jobs outside of the hospital, which puts them even at greater risk. Many workers also report feeling neglected because their public health system failed to provide them with adequate protective equipment like masks. Many of the healthcare workers also suffer from high rates of chronic illness. Government data shows that 34% of healthcare workers that contracted coronavirus had pre-existing conditions such as obesity, hypertension, or diabetes, which increases the risk of dying from the virus. In addition, unlike some European countries that saw cases ebb and flow in the spring and fall, Mexico's coronaviruses have been more consistent the entire year, leaving many hospital workers exhausted. Doctors and nurses have had to share their PPE or buy equipment on their own to make up for the insufficient response from their leadership. Angry and neglected, they've held protests at hospitals. They've also had to deal with physical and verbal harassment from people who fear the workers and are more likely to spread the virus in the community. The American government has created infrastructure for high-quality masks. In March, while resources like medical-grade masks were scarce, the CDC's official recommendation to Americans was to wear cloth masks in public. Now, while cloth masks are far better than wearing nothing, they're not the most highly effective method of preventing transmission and contraction of the virus. And according to The Atlantic, America has had ample time to develop infrastructure for developing and certifying more effective masks. So what happened? Unfortunately, there's a great amount of variation in the construction of cloth masks that makes their effectiveness vary. Things like construction and fit of the homemade masks, they can't be tracked and tested to meet particular standards, and tons of uncertified medical grade masks have been popping up in stores, some of which are even less effective than even cloth ones. And testing for masks isn't always up to snuff either. There are a wide range of test methods, and some of them examine masks in inappropriate conditions. This leaves Americans on their own when trying to choose the safest option while medical masks like N95s remain scarce. While other countries have been handling masking their citizens much more effectively, I'm shocked. Hong Kong distributed lab-tested six-layer masks to everyone. In Taiwan, citizens were receiving weekly supplies of high-quality masks as early as April. Jeez. All right. No, I think that's great. I'm just more like, how come we can't do that here? By now, the nation should have ramped up supply and increased testing capacity for masks. We also should have ensured that all Americans could get them for free, as they have in countries with the most effective mask programs. So Harvard's doctor, Abar Karan, says that because some refuse to wear them, there's even a more dire need for higher quality masks, and masks that could protect the wearer from infection should be encouraged to use. And as we say here at COVID Noise Filter, wear your mask, wear your mask, wear your mask, 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 avoid crowds, socially distance, please get vaccinated when you have an opportunity to do so, and wear your mask. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Dr. Derry and I have a daily show at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time, where we go into more detail on stories and answer your questions about COVID-19.
You can find Doc Griggs at Doc Griggs1 on social media, and you can find me at